Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Greenhorns, this is Severin. This is Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers by young farmers. And today we're talking about ranching with Joe Morris from Morris Ranch in California. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Severin. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thanks.
So usually we don't have that many ranchers, so this is a very exciting thing. And I thought the first thing to talk about was just a little bit of basics of pasture in California and how you were grazing on it.
Okay. All right. Well, pasture in California where we are is mainly constituted by annual grasses, annual plants, and they're large watersheds, large landscape ranches. And we graze about 5,000 acres on three separate ranches, and these rangelands are they're big watersheds leading down to towns and onward to the Pacific Ocean, San Francisco Bay, Monterey Bay, where we are, et cetera. So That's kind of where it is. It rains, hopefully, in the wintertime, anywhere between, you know, November and usually starts to dwindle in April and May. And then it's pretty dry for the summer and fall between June, even May in some places, all the way until, you know, October or November. That's where we are.
And so you're grazing there in the summer, in the winter, especially hard, but all year round. And how did you get into this business, and how have you changed the business that you run since you got into it?
Well, I they tell me I was born with my boots on. Even though I was born in San Francisco and raised there, my grandparents were in the cattle business. And I had a, and so I would visit them on and during vacations and so forth, and really loved being around the animals and the rangelands, and my grandfather was a great California cowboy, which is to say he was a vaquero, and he combined in a pretty in a beautiful way the you know, the love of the ranching business with the love of the vaquero heritage, which was the working men and women at this point who worked with the animals and took care of the animals and the land, and it was really beautiful. And so I just was really attracted to that. And so when I got out of college, I decided to throw my hat in the ring and really try to make a go of it. So I worked on some very large ranches in Nevada and Arizona. And then after a while, I made it back to California to where I sort of began. And so what we've tried to bring to the ranching in California is a holistic perspective. I learned about holistic management from Alan Savory, and it just made sense to me that there was a symbiotic relationship between grazing animals and the plants they graze and the soils and the atmosphere and the society around us. And so that's what we've tried to implement. And a lot of the tools and practices that the tools of grazing and animal impact that Alan Savory has talked so eloquently about have been used in California for, you know, for a couple of centuries. But it doesn't mean that they've been used to the benefit of, or at least to the potential that they can be used. And so we have tried to explore some of the, and experiment with some of the practices that that reflect Alan Savory's understanding of how grazing works, how animal impact works, and what he's observed among wild herds. We've tried to put that in place and practice that with our domestic herds on annual grasslands in California. And it's been a great but wild ride, and we've learned a ton about how these things work, and we're continuing to learn. But it hasn't really been all that well received. Ranches are idiosyncratic by nature, and they sort of keep us at an arm length, or at least our ranching practices. You know, they'll invite me to the brandings and so forth because I'm capable, but they're not that interested in what we're doing on the land. They see it as more work than is necessary and not particularly profitable. And we've tried to show
that. Do you see a difference? I mean, this is always the question, is how do you transmit such, you know, good practices once you learn them beyond the learner? But do you see a difference in the land? Like, do you have greener hills longer, or do you fatten up faster, or do you feel like the drought tolerance of your pastures is higher because of organic matter? Or how do you, to yourself, justify the more work?
Well, I think all of the above is seen on our ranches, but not dramatically enough for our neighbors. You know, if you come on our ranches, you will notice that there's something different. You'll see riparian areas that have not been fenced out, by the way, that are vigorous and thriving, and the creeks have, they're clear and they're running longer, and they're clean water, and they've got vegetated sides, and they're beautiful. And you know, our perennial grass populations are expanding. What we're trying to do now is we're trying to do a better job of producing those things, and a better job of what we have probably most seriously missed, and that is to document these things, so that it's not just a story. It's driven by data, or at least backed up by data. And that's been a challenge. I mean, there's only so many hours in the day, and my strengths do not lie in the world of Excel spreadsheets and data points. So I've been interested in doing the work on the land and hoping that, you know, as those things produced the beauty and the biodiversity and the thriving ranching culture on my places, people would be more curious. And I think that is happening. I think without question it's happening. And now it's time to get data.
So again, the data is obviously, you know, science is nice, but explain a little bit, what is the potential in terms of ranch lands in the United States and elsewhere in the world? What is the potential for that land if we were to manage it and optimize? I'm sorry, there's geese in the background. I need to. I didn't realize they were so talkative, but when I talk, they talk. What is the potential in terms of carbon and in terms of the larger ecosystem that these places are a part of? You mentioned this riparian area. Not everyone area is going to know about fencing animals out of riparian areas unless they've been applying for money for fencing. So maybe those two issues together, if you could answer them.
Yeah, I can. I think, I'm not sure we actually know what the limits are of the potential of rangelands to help the human community out with some of the more intractable problems we're facing these days, namely namely a shortage of water and changing climate, warming climate, and falling biodiversity, and people, rural communities leaving the land. Those are all very serious problems, and healthy rangelands managed, if we improve our management, if we actually explore what the potential is to really manage well that relationship between the grazing animals, be they wild or be they domesticated, and the plants that they're grazing, I think there's tremendous potential. I think that the annual grasslands in California can become much more or maybe even predominantly perennial grasslands. And when that happens, you have a series, and this is just through the management of our grazing animals, the grazing that they do and their impact on the land, namely the trampling and things that affect that cycling of carbon and minerals and so forth. And what I see on our ranches is we see annual rangelands. First what happens is we produce bigger annual, by managing the plants and animals, we produce bigger amounts of annuals. Then, by using animal impact, we eat some of it, and they trample down the plants, and they cover the soil, and they put some of that plant material, carbon, biomass, into the soil. And when that happens, we start to see a shift between annual grasses and perennial grasses. And then following that shift, we begin to build root mass and consequently soil deeper and deeper into the soil profile. And when that happens, we are able to hold water, more water, for longer periods of time, which mitigates drought, as you mentioned earlier, and which produces more food for microbes, the bacteria and the fungi and all the other critters below the soil surface, and more food for the communities above the surface, including people. And that's a really good thing, because that mitigation of drought is basically, you know, increased water holding capacity. And it also, when those roots get bigger and deeper, what you're basically doing is you're taking carbon from the atmosphere, which we know is in excess, and you're putting it into a place where it can be of real service to the rest of the community. It can produce more food, it can be more food, and it can actually be stored there in a very stable place, deep in the soil, for long periods of time. And so as that happens, and this productivity of the rangelands improves, that improves the bottom line, the economic lives of the people who are doing the work. That makes it more likely that they will continue to do the work, that their work will be more attractive to the kids, the young people, and as we repopulate our rural areas, we'll have more people doing more stewardship, and this thing will just get better and more interesting.
Well, for those people who are interested in this phase by phase, shift by shift process in improving the ecological vitality of the rangelands, one outcome of that is also this moving atmospheric carbon and into the soil to become soil carbon. And research has been pursued in Marin County by the Marin Carbon Project. They've been publishing some scientific papers. Courtney White, the Kivira Coalition, is just about to publish a book called The Carbon Rant. And there is increased amounts of evidence pointing and suggesting that this kind of management would have major impact on our atmospheric carbon, or could potentially be did over larger areas. That's something for those of you who are thinking, aha, this overlaps with my interest in environmental science, and, or environmental issues. There's a good set of places to write a term paper. Joe, here's a question about viability. How come you have so many thousands of acres, and the really is that the size that you have to have to be economically viable?
I'm sorry, Severin, I'm having a little difficulty understanding what that last question was.
Yes, Severin, oh, you're breaking up.
The question was, why are you 5,000 acres? Is what you have to be to stay to be viable? How did you choose that size?
Well, rangelands in California are not that productive. It takes a lot of land to run a single animal unit, 10 to 20 acres. So, you know, scale changes around the world, on rangelands around the world, which by the way, rangelands are the most, you know, they cover most of the Earth's surface outside of the ocean. I'm told, and they have a tremendous potential to have management create these effects on rangelands and to sequester carbon in their rangeland soils, because virtually around the globe we'll find rangelands in brittle or dry, semi-arid environments are degraded. They are not rising to their potential in terms of productivity. And productivity, how do we get greater productivity is we first have to move from bare soil or annual grasses to covered soil and perennial grass. And that's when we can start seeing this real boost in productivity and that productivity feeds lots of diverse life and it you know, and that water holding capacity and all those things sort of fit together. And so in California, the landscapes are just simply larger right now. They're not that productive. And so I didn't particularly set out to manage any number of acres. I just am trying to make a living and make a middle class living on the Central Coast. And we do that by managing right now this particular number of acres and then marketing our animals as grass-fed beef and creating community at every step of the way. The biological communities on the rangeland are feeding the people in towns, and that's our aim. Our goal is to build community and to reunite or sort of help people in town understand and feel their relationship to the land from which their food grows. And so, you know, that's what we're doing, and that's why we're on 5,000 acres right now.
And is that a similar size kind of unit as most people in around your area, or is that small or large?
It's medium. You know, most of the cattle producers in the United States do it on the side. They do it as a hobby. So most of the herds, I think, I haven't read this statistic in a while, but they're less than 40 animals or fewer than 40, 50 animals. So that's not an economic unit. It's not intended as an economic unit. It's intended as an attractive hobby. And so we don't have that as a hobby. That's our principal business, and so our scale is larger. And we also have more families and people involved than just a hobbyist would have. There are ranches that are much larger than ours. Your sponsor, Harris Ranch, is larger than not Harris Ranch. Hearst Ranch is larger than we are by many times, and then there are lots of smaller ranches as well. So it's another complex community.
And so the other question I'm sure we're going to get emails asking otherwise if we don't explain. Will you explain how there's a difference in the mama cow business from stalkers and what we mean by stalkers and what role those stalkers can play healing the landscape?
Well, stalkers are, I think everybody knows what, a cow and a calf is, and so that's the brood cow herd. And then stockers are generally younger cattle that are seasonally or temporarily on any given ranch. For example, on one of our ranches, we run cattle that actually come from Hawaii, and they are either flown or trucked in, not trucked, but come on barges from the islands where there is insufficient, you know, there's not that many people. So the animals come over here, and because of relatively inexpensive oil, it somehow still makes sense. Anyway, they come to our ranches for 6 months, and under our management, they do beautiful stuff on the land. They do all these things on the land that our mother cow herd does on a different ranch. So they can serve a purpose. And they also serve the purpose, particularly, I think, if our audience is young people, of it basically serves as a loan, not from a bank, but from a fellow rancher who has cattle that you can manage and not have a lot of capital to get going. And we were in that position. We're still in that position. Animals are very expensive. So we run other people's cattle. We use other people's money, and we use other people's land, renting land and borrowing from any you know, banks, friends, etc.
And so the people whose cattle that is, the Hawaiian cattle, they pay you a rate per pound gain, or how does, like, what's the...
That's how it works. If we manage the animals in a way that they gain weight, they pay us a set amount per pound of gain. And every deal is a little bit different. Sometimes there are incentives for higher weight gain. Sometimes it's a set fee. But that's between the two ranchers.
So that sounds like a good segue to my next question, which is exactly as you mentioned, for those who are young people wanting to get into ranching and who think, wow, 5,000 acres, that's not going to happen. What would be the way to get into the industry in the beginning, and then what could you kind of expect over the course of a life's work to build up for your kids?
Well, I think, first of all, I would say that if you begin with the thought that that's not going to happen, you're going to produce that thought. And so what I would do is I would spend a little time imagining what you would like to have happen. And I wouldn't nail it down as 5,000 acres. I would just write, you know, what qualities in my life would I like to really... I would like to characterize my everyday life, and for me that's peacefulness and a healthy community, and then what do you need to do to support that life economically? You need to produce things, one of which is money, and if your production has to do with land, you're going to want to produce a certain kind of landscape that will support that production, which supports that quality of life forever. And that's what Alan Savory calls a holistic goal, and that drives the holistic decision-making process. There's lots of ways into this thing. I didn't begin with 5,000 acres. I began with 200, and I began with some borrowed money, and I began, you know, just going out and doing it on these 200 acres. And I wanted to do it really, really well. And as I did it really, really well, and I leased another 50 acres there and another, you know, 100 acres there, and some of the places were almost lease free. They just wanted management, and so I supplied that. And it was difficult, but you know, that's the way it is. So at this point there's ranchers like myself and bigger ranchers who have the capacity to hire young people. So, you know, there's lots of different ways of getting into this thing. And I think it all begins with that imagined, what do I want to have happen, reality. And frankly, we need people. We need lots of people to do this work. There's risk involved because not everything is, you know, not all the techniques are worked out. And people are going to have to be very creative on how to work them out and how to do the experiments in a way that is leads to or is economically sound. I think that right now is a good time. I think there's lots of people who are interested in these ideas, and there is, depending on where you are, there's you don't have to have a huge amount of land, and there are lands, you know, that are underutilized because the people who have purchased a farm, say, that's 200 acres and lots of grass and wooded, don't really want to or don't know how to manage. So they might, you know, offer the land for just the management. I found those opportunities, and I think they're there. So, yeah.
Well, I very much appreciate your time in explaining these things and encouraging us to pursue our dreams.
You're welcome.
And starting small. And again, so, you know, just from a statistical point of view, it's often said that the average farmer is 57 or 58 years old. For right. ranchers, it's more like 60, 65. And
yeah.
So while that means that we really got to cherish the old timers and get near them enough to hear what they have to say, it also means that there's an amazing opportunity right now to be a part of the transition, of that stewardship, of that land, of those existing operations, and to bring new operations onto land that's whose ranchers are retiring. So, yes, it's a scary amount of people who are leaving, but it also means that it's a really tremendous opportunity to increase and improve our management of these rangelands.
Yeah, yeah. And I think another thing that needs to be, you know, pointed out is that while we should honor the older people who are working on these ranch lands, we're no longer limited by the local understanding of things. The local understanding of things is really important, and we ought to, respectfully look at that very carefully. But we also have available to us through the Internet and, you know, these conferences that are global in scope, lots of wisdom from other communities. And often, you know, ecologically, the edge effect is where more life happens, most of the life happens, and change happens. And so young people combining with the older generation that has the local knowledge, combining that with what they can find around them in other places can really have a dramatic effect on how well people can succeed in this business.
That's beautifully said, and a perfect moment to remind our listeners that the Quivira Coalition Conference is coming up. It's always in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and it's always wonderful. This year it's about expanding food production to meet the global demand as humanity increases and explodes. How can we meet that appetite? And it's in November. It's the 12th through the 15th of November, I think. Maybe check it. And we'll be there, and a bunch of wonderful speakers are going to be going. I don't know if you're going, Joe, but it's an awesome time.
Yeah.
Oh, you're
right. I am. Yeah. And it's the 14th through the 16th of November.
Oh, my apologies.
No, that's okay. Two heads are better than one, Severin.
And then a couple other resources to tag. And Joe, you can think if you have any to add to this. Holistic Management International has free PDFs on their website that can help you get started thinking about your holistic plan, your holistic goals, and how to frame your progress towards those goals. And then obviously there's many books by Alan Savory and others that you could pay for, but you can get a lot for free just by Googling. Anything else you want to add, Joe?
Well, what I just said, two heads are better than one. So don't do this in isolation. You know, find a group, find friends, have fun, and, you know, really, really don't be afraid to experiment.
Well, that sounds good. And this has been another wonderful session of Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers and ranchers, and by those same people. And upcoming events, just so you know, we have a farm hack coming up in Ithaca, New York. The focus is on small grains processing. Will be hosted by Cayuga Organics, which is a farmers cooperative. It's also co-sponsored by Groundswell and NOFA New York. The focus, again, is on hacking equipment, either old or borrowed or broken, to do small-scale grains. Very, very applicable to many of us who are working more grains into rotation. And worth planning to do that big drive because Cornell is kind of far away. And there's Farm Hack Brooklyn in November. We have a lot on the schedule, so go check it out at www.thegreenhorn.net. And look forward to speaking with you next week. Bye-bye. Oh, I got to wash my hands.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.